Welcome to the Software Process and Measurement Cast number 587. I'm Tom Cagley, your host, and in the Spamcast 587, we're breaking cadence and featuring another interview. Ryan Ripley and Todd Miller and I discuss their new book, Fixing Your Scrum, Practical Solutions to Common Scrum Problems. We discussed how to define broken Scrum processes. Ryan and Todd make a point that Scrum is so much more than a checklist of practices to follow, yet that's exactly how many organizations practice it. Their book is an important step to fixing that problem. Todd's bio. Todd is a professional Scrum trainer for Scrum.org and a VP of Agile Innovation Practices at Intro Group LLC. He has professional experience as a Scrum Master, Product Owner, Developer, and Agile Coach on a variety of technical and creative projects across multiple industries. He presently coaches and trains enterprises and teams across the United States on the Scrum framework, enterprise agile transformation, and professional software development. Ryan's bio. Ryan is a professional Scrum trainer with the Scrum.org. Ryan Ripley has experience as a software developer, manager, director, Scrum Master at various Fortune 500 companies in medical device, wholesale, and financial service industries. He's the host of Agile for Humans, another podcast you should be listening to. Ryan lives in Indiana with his wife and three children. He blogs at ryanripley.com and is on Twitter at @ryanripley. Most recently, Ryan co-authored Fixing Your Scrum, Practical Solutions to Common Scrum Problems with Todd Miller. Ryan is also a keynote speaker and travels internationally to present on Scrum and Agile topics. Are you ready to fix your Scrum? It's time for the interview. Ryan Ripley and Todd Miller, welcome to the Software Process and Measurement Cast.
Hey, thanks, Tom.
Yeah, thank you.
Ryan, this is your second time. This is excellent. I always love return people. Todd, this is the first time. Welcome, welcome. You guys have a new book, Fixing Your Scrum, Practical Solutions to Common Scrum Problems. Why'd you guys write this?
So Todd and I have been either doing or thinking about or theorizing about Scrum for the better part of the past 20 years. And at some point, it was just odd. We're like, you know, we're seeing the same things over and over and over again. You know, we see the absent product owner. We see the disengaged Scrum Master. We see organizations who want to change the framework to kind of hide impediments. And every place we were going into, every professional Scrum course that we were teaching, we'd get the same questions. We're like, you know what? What if we just, like we didn't want to do the normal Scrum book. Like there's hundreds of books on the market that here's what Scrum is, here's how you do it, here's the basics. And there's plenty of those books on the market. They're all great, but we wanted to do something a little more. And so we decided, what if we just took all of the anti-patterns, all of these questions that we get, we're going to put them in the book, organize it by the Scrum events, the roles of the artifacts, and just basically pretend that we're walking into a company, they're having trouble with this aspect of Scrum, and we're going to put everything that we know and everything that we've tried to help teams correct this anti-pattern just straight into the book, right? So hold nothing back. Let's just have an ultimately practical, pragmatic type of stance on Scrum and help teams get back to healthy delivery, joyful work, and a more, I guess, aligned to the Scrum Guide view of the framework itself.
Yeah, and Ryan and I started co-training PSM2s a lot, the Scrum.org Advanced Scrum Master class, and I remember a couple of conversations that emerged from some eavesdropping we would do with students as they were talking about mistakes they had made in being a Scrum Master. And Ryan and I think, had a lot of dinner conversations over mistakes that we've made and why we made them and where the root of those were and how we've inevitably fixed those mistakes. So I think some of that is, or some of our stories are in there, as well as what Brian was saying, these common things that we just see over and over and over again in organizations in order to change Scrum because they don't want to change your organization, right?
Well, and you know, Todd actually brings up one of the more difficult aspects of the book. Like we had to really sit down and decide, do we just tell a bunch of stories about us screwing up the framework and then what we did to fix it or how we worked with teams to fix it? And we went ahead and said, yeah, let's just put all of our failure stories in it. Let's make sure that people realize that we're just as good at messing up the framework as they are, but here's the things we've tried over the years. And hopefully, you know, a scrum master, a product owner, a manager, a dev team who's ever reading this book, hopefully they look in and they say, oh, I recognize that mistake. And oh, maybe this is a cool idea. And if there's just one or two of those in there for each team, I think Todd and I will be happy.
Mistakes, broken scrum practices, how do you define those?
Yeah, so that's going to be different for, I think, every organization. What we've tried to do in the book is just say, the Scrum Guide is it is the definition of Scrum, and we start at that point and work out. And so if you're doing Scrum according to the way that Ken and Jeff envisioned it, we think that's a great path to be on. But when we see these anti-patterns, we start seeing, and the way that I would define it is, modifications to an aspect of Scrum, whether it's an artifact, a role, or an event, that modification is often being used to hide some kind of organizational impediment. That to me is a mistake. Like if someone's just performing the role in a way that they're learning and they're growing, I don't think that's a mistake. That's just human nature, natural progression. We learn as we go. But when we intentionally do something to change the framework, to change the way that it was intended to be used because we're afraid to deal with an impediment, or we're not really focused on solving organizational problems, I think that to me, I think that's the framing for a mistake. I mean, what do you think, Todd?
Yeah, you know, I think you hit the nail on the head there when you mention changing the framework because not wanting to cope with an organizational impediment. And an example of that might be how an organization is structured, meaning we still have a test team and a development team, and the development team hands off to the test team, or the way even projects are budgeted. We're going to do this project in Scrum, but we can't budget it and give you money for it until we have a robust list of requirements before we start. So Ryan, I think that we see these things quite a bit in an organization, or in many organizations. And I think that we view those as organizational impediments that Scrum Masters should be actively trying to tackle.
Why are we still having these discussions? I mean, this is not like Scrum is brand new. We know when things are broken. We know that doing some of these things are hiding organizational impediments, organizational structure problems, all of those things. Why is this still a conversation?
So I'll open. I think that one thing, and Ryan and I have talked about this at great lengths, many beers and hotel dinners have been had over our feelings about how the Scrum Master role has been greatly diminished in a lot of organizations. And by saying that, a Scrum Master is often interpreted as a team manager, right? And they're not given the whole authority to be viewed as someone that is capable and should be have the authority to stop these organizational impediments and remove them, right? So I think that is absolutely one factor, that the Scrum Master has largely been viewed as, we talk about this a lot in our classes, as a team secretary. You know, that's we're out of coffee pods. The Scrum Master needs to get more coffee for us, or we didn't see that meeting on the schedule. You forgot somebody, Scrum Master, right? And that's widely been how the world has interpreted that role, when it is meant to be much more powerful than that.
Yeah, I think that misunderstanding of the role that Todd talks about is really important. But I think there's a larger market thing going on as well. So in organizations, a Scrum Master role has been diminished. But if you look at the markets today, consolidation is rampant. Competition is at its highest. You know, the world's largest hotel chain is Airbnb. They own zero property. You know, the taxi cab industry has been devastated by Lyft and Uber. You know, the blue chip stocks that we used to talk about when we were kids, like Kodak and Blockbuster and BlackBerry, they're all diminished to either nothing or different roles. And so I think that accelerated competition and consolidation is now kind of at the forefront. And I think organizations in the past that have been kind of fat, happy, and dumb, they haven't had to adopt agile practices or frameworks. They've been able to sit on large reserves of cash. And I think what we're seeing today is, at least with the companies I'm going to visit, they are realizing that if we don't compete and adapt and change and align to customers, we're out. And so now I think some would say Scrum's 20 years old, but I would say for the majority of the world, they're just now starting to adopt it. I think we've just begun and we're still repeating the same problems. And so I think there's a lot of combinations of things here. And, you know, it's part of why we wrote the book. We want to, you know, selfishly, Todd and I go into these companies and we see the same problems and it's not interesting. Like we want to, we're hoping that by putting this body of knowledge out there that companies kind of elevate a bit, they improve their practices to the point to where we go in and the problems are more complex. We're actually solving product related problems, not framework problems, that we're able to work on, you know, meeting needs in the marketplace. And we're trying to get people past some of these initial things. And so lots of moving parts here, Tom, as I know you're well aware, but yeah, I think the world's just moving faster than it ever has. And the companies that don't adopt some kind of agile practice, I think they're in big trouble and they're now mostly realizing it.
So I'll put a darker spin on why I think we're still seeing these problems. And in some cases, seeing them over and over and over again in the same organization is that there are a lot of people who either believe that they know what Agile is, what Scrum is, what XP is, what Kanban is, and they then immediately implement it and then say, but that's the way I've always done it. It must work.
There is this horrible belief in our industry around best practices.
my favorite phrase of all times.
I mean, it's a horrible phrase, and I wish that we could stop using that phrase, especially in a complex space like product development.
Mm-hmm.
There is no such thing as a best practice. Like the things that we do today, like our podcast setups. Like I just realized that I don't have the best setup, and I have new equipment sitting next to me.
Cool.
I've got to up my game because, I mean, podcast equipment is fun, but it's also time to modernize what I'm doing. And it's the same thing with companies and their agile practices and their frameworks and even their understanding. Todd, I think you would agree with this. We've been thinking about Scrum for the better part of 20 years, and we're still learning and evolving and changing. This book has really forced us to question everything that we believed about Scrum, and some of our opinions changed. Like we actually sat down and thought about these things and we're like, well, wait a minute, we've been doing this way for a long time, and man, we need to switch, and let's get this in the book and let's get this in our practice. So this whole like playbook, best practices, you know, steps 1 to 1,000 mindset that people bring into Agile. I think, Tom, you're right. It's pretty insidious to the practice. It has caused a lot of the anti-patterns, and hopefully in the book, we've really carved out a section where it's just Taylorism is a failure. Best practices do not exist. Empiricism is your friend. You have to inspect and adapt everything you're doing constantly so that you're still relevant and you have a chance at success.
You know, Ryan, this reminds me of something that we talk about quite a bit, and it's how we oftentimes see companies try to come up with a way to adopt agile practices by using waterfall.
Yeah.
Like, we'll start using Scrum when SharePoint is full of all the practices that every team is going to use for when we adopt Scrum. So I think that notion of best practices is where a lot of people get into trouble. And I think, Tom, you hit the nail on the head there to some degree. And for going the continuous learning adventure that it takes to build a really good product, right?
Both of you went through a journey, obviously, to write the book. And you know, Ryan, you sort of intimated that you changed how you thought about certain things as you went through the book, writing the book process. How did writing a book together actually change not only your practice, but how you think about the world?
Yeah, so what was interesting is that Todd and I have some pretty similar aspects in our backgrounds, but we kind of have a different path. And so I think what it forced both of us to do is think about things in a different way. It gave us a soundboard, not an echo chamber. And so we were able to bounce ideas off each other. And we, you know, as Todd mentioned, the trainer life is glamorous, you know, Holiday Inn Expresses and lots of hotel dinners. And we would have a lot of these conversations where we didn't always agree, but we respected each other. We kind of kept that conversation going. We, We really had to sharpen our understanding of why. And I think part of what it changed for me is that it made me really respect the genius of Ken Schwaber quite a bit more. You know, they put 17 pages in a script. That's all it is for the framework. But there's so much there. And when you sit down and have these difficult conversations, as Todd and I would debate, as we would think about the framework, we'd realize just how bright Ken and Jeff are, and the way that they've put together this framework really was genius, still is today. You know, one example is like the sprint goal. You know, Todd and I both believe it's required, it's necessary, it's essential, but just the importance of it, like we went more in depth in our thinking than I think we ever have on that topic. And we realized, and I don't remember who said it, I don't remember how many beers were involved at the time, but maybe that's those two things are related. But we realized like the sprint goal is not just some way to explain your sprint backlog, and it's not some way to capture scope. It's this is how we connect teams to the customer. And when we had that, as we're going back and forth and that comment comes out, we're like, wait a minute, that's genius, right? We're going to connect teams to a customer through the sprint goal. That's why this thing is so important. We had never really seen anyone write or talk about it in that way, except for Ken and except for Jeff. But once we had that realization, it's like, oh, wait a minute, we've got to get this in the book, and we've got to talk about how, you know, the sprint goal is just so much more than, you know, a summary of your sprint backlog. It's how you inspire a dev team. You know, you if you can connect the dev team to their purpose, if you can show them how they're connected to the customer through that goal, they want to change the world, right? And so that was just one of the things that changed in my Scrum thinking, you know, how it changed my world in general. You know, it made me appreciate working with others, right? I think far too often, especially in our American culture, it's I have to succeed or fail on my own. Everything's a competition. You know, working with Todd it's been great. And we were able to, you know, there were chapters that I struggled with that he would pick up and fix. And there were chapters that he was, you know, stressing out over. And I'd say, all right, man, just check it in and I'll pull it down and let's take a look. And it was just work is better together, and trying to build partnerships and collaborative relationships. And I think that's going to be the impact on me going forward, is that it's, you know, solo recognition is fine, but when you accomplish something with a writing partner or as a team, I think life is so much better.
Yeah. And I think for me, I mean, I loved our debates, right? We had some really good debates. And I think that in terms of us working together, it was good debates, right? It was good conflict. And I think that really hit the nail on the head for me, that like the conflict that we had was very, we were searching for the right answer, you know? And to me, above the topic of sprint goals is what really solidified it, and going through and really digging in and all the conversations that we had and all the writing that we did, is that if you really emphasize empiricism, if you really emphasize inspection, adaptation, and transparency, and that, and those are levers, right? You could be putting something into place that creates an inspection opportunity, but negatively impacts the transparency of a Scrum team. That is really at the core of everything. And I think we found that, and especially talking about our war stories, right? And then we tied that into the Scrum values and how empiricism and the Scrum values combined are so, so powerful and really applicable to everything in life, right? So I think that that was a real big epiphany that, I mean, I knew that, you know, and I believed I knew every aspect of that, but just diving into it, I don't know that you ever can, right? I think that is just something that if you live by it and your Scrum teams live by, you know, heightening empirical process control and living the Scrum values, that how utterly important that is to everything outside of a framework or a best practice or even your coding standard. Like those things are just materialistic almost as compared to what empiricism and the Scrum values bring. And I must say, writing, I definitely feel like my writing ability, even in an email, is much better. And a huge shout out to our editor, Don. Ryan has said this multiple times, and I couldn't agree with him more. She makes us sound much smarter than we are. She was amazing. Sometimes it was a little bit of a gut punch when Ryan and I would be co-writing a chapter and we'd check in and be like, this is awesome. We're high-fiving. And she'd be like, this is boring.
True story.
Yeah, and we're just like, oh man, we just spent 6 hours after training in a hotel lobby jamming on this chapter, thinking it's amazing, and she brought us down to earth, but all for really good reason, and I think really helped us become better writers, even in something as simple as an email. Right?
I don't know that emails are ever simple. Much shorter.
Yeah. 3 sentences or less.
Yeah, that's right. So, that's right.
Tomorrow morning, somebody goes out and buys the book and consumes it over the remainder of the weekend. How would you expect them to be different?
You know, it's funny. I just got to talk to someone who consumed the book in that manner this morning, and they actually told me how they're different, which was really humbling, and it stunned me. And they said, look, Ryan, I never appreciated the Scrum values before your book. You know, most of the other books out there on Scrum, they talk about the framework, the mechanics. They give like some, you know, cursory tips and cautions, and they move on. And he's like, with your book, I finally realized that I have to coach the Scrum values to the team, and that those values bring life to the framework, that those values influence behavior, that those values can change a culture in an organization. And I was just like, I mean, I was so happy that that message shined through, but I think that they were dead on serious, that the values will change the way they look at work and the behaviors of their teams.
Yeah. And that's awesome. And I think another thing that we've often discussed is the why behind some of these things, right? Why is this particular anti-pattern a bad idea, and the impact that it has on empiricism and the Scrum values?
Yep.
It's easy just to read an internet article and it says, "What you shouldn't do Sprint Zero," right? But why shouldn't you? What impact could it have on your product delivery? And I think that our hope is that brings a heightened awareness and really recharges the Scrum world into going out and tackling the things that need to change in an organization for them to really reach true agility. So I think that along with what Ryan said, the why behind some of these things is really important.
One of the critical problems that I think doesn't generally get tackled, even when you have a good implementation of Scrum, is the technical side of the discussion. I recently interviewed a whole bunch of people out of the University of Pennsylvania's IT group. A couple of them were grad students. Well, A, none of them knew Scrum, which was its own issue, or any other agile framework. But what they also didn't know then was how to work in small iterations. No one had given them the technical acumen to actually work in an agile team where they actually have to do something, get it all the way to done, and actually implement it and show that it works in a short period of time. Do we do a disservice by not addressing the technical side of what makes this work?
So I would venture to tell you that the technical community has suffered from a lot of the anti-patterns that we've written in the book. I have a background in development for many years. I've worked on many waterfall projects.
Cool.
On many Scrum projects. Yeah. And nobody gave me a how-to guide to build emergent architecture when we moved to extreme programming. That's a thing, right?
And
So we'll get called in to do a Scrum Master course for the PMO. And sometimes the development teams don't even have a Pluralsight account, right? To learn how to do automated testing, to learn how to emergently build architecture. So I think that technical discussion is something that it's really important to me that somehow, some way that emerges. And I know a lot of people are doing a lot of really great work in that realm. But I couldn't agree with you anymore to say that, what are we doing there, right? How are we going to change that? And how are we going to make sure that one of the anti-patterns that we don't just exhaustively build an architecture and then say, okay, development team, now go do it, right? Or just shoot from the hip and cowboy it until you have mounds of technical debt that are insurmountable and you end up rewriting it, right? So
Yeah, I heard people defend that both of those practices recently. It made my head hurt.
We have to focus on quality, right? Like that, that is a non-negotiable aspect of this.
It's funny, and obviously, you know, you guys can see I actually have gray hair. That was part and parcel of the last quality revolution that sort of got swept under the carpet. People like Capers Jones back, you know, in the early dawn of the century, was really focused on quality and really was able to tie that mathematically back to actually high efficiency and getting more value out and all those good things.
Yeah, the technical side just... You know, Todd and I were one of these debates that we would have at night. He finally turned to me and he goes, "So, I mean, what do you think? Can we have good scrum with a poor development team?" And I'm like, "Well, no, of course not." And that was a light bulb. It's like, wait a minute, we have to start here. And it, I mean, I'm leaving off a lot of context. Of course, I was a developer first too, and but it was just one of those. It's so easy to kind of lose sight of that. It's technical excellence is a part of professional scrum. And so we teach that as part of, you know, professional scrum trainers with scrum.org. That's part of, I mean, that's at the heart and soul of what Ken believes within a scrum team. It's a technical excellence is part of that professionalism that he sets the tone for. And it's just, and so, yeah, in the book, we talk about it. It's with these teams, you have to have, you know, excellent testing practices and strategies or else scrum will fall flat. Like you cannot do months of manual regression testing and deliver in a 1 month sprint. Like it just does not work. The math doesn't fit, the calendar breaks, right? And so we did try to spend a lot of time there and say, you know, for me, and I we'll see what Todd thinks about this too. I think Scrum combined with XP is just a perfect marriage. Like it's, I think Kent Beck wrote one of the most important books of our time with Extreme Programming Explained. And I wish that more, the dev teams that I work with, I buy copies of it for them. I think it's like, read this and embrace it, you know, and then go off and find, you know, the Pluralsight courses, whatever you need to level up. Like the tech side is so important. And if we can bring that stuff into Scrum, because XP fits beautifully with Scrum, I think then you get closer to that professional vision that we're after. And yeah, I think it's so important. You cannot do great professional Scrum without an awesome dev team.
Yeah. And Ryan, XP, you know, that just made me smile because, you know, I absolutely love that conversation. And it's much more than just the practices that Kent Beck wrote about, right? It's the principles behind it and what it takes to be a really good development team member. And we do touch on that in our book. We don't directly tell you how to be, it's not a technical book, right? We didn't write code in it to say, this is how you unit test. But we did write stories and examples of teams that that didn't have done increments at the end of a sprint and what impact that had on an organization and the impact of what happens when a team accumulates technical debt. But circling back, yeah, I couldn't agree more with the XP conversation, Ryan, with what you're saying. And you know, I have a deep affection for it.
Yeah. What you don't see is over on my bookshelf, I actually have 7 or 8 XP books. Big fan. Gentlemen, you wake up tomorrow morning, somebody hands you a cup of coffee or your caffeinated beverage of choice and a magic wand and says that you are allowed to change any 2 practices that are typically screwed up or messed up or any of your other words you want, scrum problems. What would those 2 be and why?
So I'll do one and then give Ryan the opportunity to think of one. Ryan, does that work for you?
I like it. Yeah.
Okay, cool. You did this to me yesterday, so I'm hooking you up today.
Nice. Stall, Todd, stall.
So number one, let's have a metrics conversation.
Yeah.
Right. And I can't talk about this enough. If I have to go in, as Ryan said, we're tired of fixing some of these practices and explain why velocity isn't a performance metric. It's been 7 years, 8 years of my life having to do that, right? And it's not just velocity. Let's move from the project type metrics to product type metrics. Let's measure outcomes. Let's measure employee satisfaction, customer satisfaction. Let's look at something like evidence-based management. And let's move away from those old metrics that are driving down transparency in your organization. So I'd say number one for me is let's have an open and honest conversation about metrics and how a lot of the performance metrics that are put in place in a lot of organizations really are negatively impacting a development team's ability to be transparent.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, when Ron Jeffries, the creator of Vlocity, tweets out that, hey, I may or may not be the guy who caused this, but if I am, I'm sorry. I mean, that's a pause moment for everybody to start thinking about Vlocity. So I like that one from Todd. I think for me, there is this undertone of anti-management and leadership that goes through our community that I think is too rampant. We actually wrote a chapter in the book called Management because we really wanted to help Scrum Masters get their minds shifted more towards a collaborative relationship with managers, directors, VPs, because they're essential to a successful Scrum practice. You know, there's this idea that you don't need management anymore, we're self-organizing, and that idea needs to die in a fire and go away. Like, that is just... Management and leadership set the boundaries and constraints that we need for self-organization to work. And so as Scrum Masters and product owners and whatever your role is, we have to learn how to effectively speak with leadership and to respect the fact that they have needs that our teams are going to meet as well. And so I would get rid of the anti-management, anti-leadership sentiment as my first one. I don't know, Todd, do you have a second one?
That was just enough time. But I absolutely agree. And on your topic really quick, Ryan, it's the Scrum bubbles, right? We talk about,
yeah,
like pop the Scrum bubble and start to gain some empathy to what's happening outside of your organization, outside in the world that's not doing Scrum and what's happening with your management.
I like that metaphor. Scrum
I didn't create that. Was it the Liberators?
They might have. It might be Barry and Chris over in the Netherlands.
Yeah, I'm going to make sure that I attribute that to somebody that actually created it, but I didn't. My second, I think I'm going to go back to a previous conversation we had. I want to talk about the dev team, right? The development team is full of developers that are humans. They're not resources, right? They're humans. They are not resources. These are smart, very good people, right? That we're hiring to come in and build the product for us in high quality. I think that we need to start circling back and getting those teams and those individuals to buy in to what the Scrum was meant to be, which is a framework that gives them the ability to self-organize around solving a problem, right? And we need to give them the tools to be able to do that. And we have an entire chapter. I think a couple of our chapters are exclusively towards that. We have a development team chapter. We have a chapter on creating done increments. We have a chapter on the sprint backlog. And all too often, we see that those things aren't owned by them. And I think a lot of it might be because of trust and because of that, taking that project mentality. So I will say that if I could change anything, I would say, let's empower them to build done increments and let's give them the tools that they need, not just tooling, but training and whatever else they may need to accomplish it, and give them the space to the boundaries, as Ryan says, for self-organization.
Yeah, I love that one. And I think my second one, what I would change if I could just wave a magic wand, is that I would, when we're called into organizations to work with teams, we would have the ability to start with leadership first and work down. I really think that in the Scrum adoptions I've worked on that have been successful, we ran a professional agile leadership course. We got the agile mindset at that leadership level first, and then started working with teams and started breaking down that business and IT silos. But we really, first and foremost, from the top down, got the mindset aligned in the direction we needed. Far too many times we're called in for these grassroots situations, and it just, when the leadership team isn't on board, or if they just don't know any better, sometimes you don't know what you don't know, you know, these efforts just get squashed. And so I think that would be the second change I would make from what we see over and over and over again.
Gentlemen, this has been absolutely fantastic. How would people continue the conversation?
So I think, well, first and foremost, head out to Amazon and buy the book.
Absolutely.
We're, Our publisher requires us to say that, right? I'm on Twitter at Ryan Ripley. You can go to RyanRipley.com. You know, if you hit us up on, or if you hit me up, I won't speak for Todd. If you hit me up on any of those areas, I promise to reply. That's either a guarantee or a warning, because I think we can geek out on this stuff forever. So if you hit us up either on LinkedIn, Twitter, the website, you're definitely going to get some kind of probably multiple replies back. So fair warning. But yeah, please check out the book. We'd love to hear comments on it. The feedback is what's going to help us do better next time. And yeah, we just hope it helps the world. So any of those are great. Todd, how can they talk to you?
Yeah, I'm getting a little bit more into Twitter. Ryan, thank you. He just drags me into this stuff. So I'm Todd_Miller11 on Twitter. You can find me on LinkedIn. It's Agile Todd, because there's probably 10 million Todd Millers out there. But we do take this seriously, and this is what we do, and we really want to change this. We find it vitally important to the success of organizations, as Ryan mentioned earlier in the podcast, that it's scary to think, with as fast as everything is moving, what might happen if organizations don't change.
Ryan Ripley, Todd Miller, thank you for spending time and discussing your new book, Fixing Your Scrum, Practical Solutions to Common Scrum Problems. Before we roll out, is there anything that you gentlemen would like to promote?
You know, Tom, I think just the book. I think I'm going to focus there. We really appreciate you having us on and letting us use your platform to get this message out. You know, I hope it's clear from the discussion that we're not really worried about making money off the book. We're hoping that we're elevating. We're hoping to bring some new ideas to the Scrum community, and the fact that you're helping us with this, we truly appreciate it.
Yeah, I concur. Yeah, I'd like to promote professional Scrum.
Yeah, that's what we want to get out in the world.
Super. Yeah. Well, gentlemen, it has been fantastic, and I look forward to having this conversation again, perhaps on another book or perhaps on another topic. As you probably saw, I was taking notes. There are a couple of things I'd like to pull strings on and have the conversation, but we'll do that again at another time.
Sounds great.
Thank you again. In Reread Saturday News, we continue our reread of Crucial Conversations, Tools for Talking When Stakes Are High, second edition by Patterson, Grenny, McMillan, and Switzler. Chapter 1 of Crucial Conversation provides the reader with a definition of a crucial conversation for the book, hints in recognizing this form of communication, and provides a rationale for why we should care. If you do not have a copy, or have tossed it at somebody during a crucial conversation, which I think would be a crucial conversation faux pas, it's time to buy a new copy. Please use the link in the show notes, which helps support the blog and the podcast. The Spamcast 588 features our interview with Susie Palmer True and Peter Taylor. Another book. We discuss their new book, Project Management. It's all bollocks. It was great to meet Susie and to renew our conversation with Peter. We talked about the assumptions that the profession of project management makes and why we should challenge those assumptions. If process improvement is a never-ending journey, why do so many people ask, "Are we there yet?"